The Tom Woods Show, episode 1493.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been spreading some pretty terrible ideas, and she's wrong on just about everything. Well, I've put together the definitive smash of all of it. The Green New Deal, affordable housing so-called, free college, high tax rates. It's in another free ebook, yes, a free ebook called AOC is Wrong, The Upside Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Grab your free copy at aociswrong.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I've got Peter Schiff back on the program with me. Before I get to Peter, though, just a quick reminder for those of you who remember what I was offering back on episode 1483. You know, I have my Liberty Classroom website that I love, and a lot of you are members of it. We have great courses on history and economics and other stuff where you learn the real stuff, not the propaganda. And you also know that if you use an affiliate link, so I know who you are, and somebody clicks on your link and joins the site, you and I split the dough 50-50. And I told you that if you join with Gary Kramer, our guest on episode 1483, and join his training course, as a bonus, I will for 1 year give you 100% commission. So if somebody clicks on your link, let's say you post it on Facebook, somebody clicks through and joins, you get all the money. I won't keep anything. I'll give it all to you for a year. And you may say, Woods, how do you benefit from that? And the answer is, I get their email addresses, and you know I love that. Helps me build my list. I figure if people are getting 100% commissions, they're probably going to work even harder to spread the word about my stuff, and that helps me build my email list. So you're helping me, and you're helping yourself because you're getting all the money. But this offer ends in a few days from now. I'm talking to you September 16th, 2019. It's all over the end of the day, September 19th, 2019. So get the details at tomwoods.com/replay if that holds any attraction for you. In the meantime, we've got Peter Schiff here, and Peter's going to be answering some questions that were submitted via the Tom Woods Show Elite, which is my secret group, accessible through the Supporting Listeners program at supportinglisteners.com. So you should belong to that. So among other things, you can submit questions for people like Peter. Peter is Chief Global Strategist at Euro-Pacific Capital. He's chairman of Schiff Gold and host of The Peter Schiff Show, which is an ongoing podcast that continues the work of the old Peter Schiff Show radio program, which I used to fill in for. Peter's the author of numerous books, including Crash Proof, The Real Crash, and The Little Book of Bull Moves in Bear Markets. Peter, welcome back.
Tom, glad to be back.
I want to start off with just asking about your, not new, but newish digs. You were in Puerto Rico. You were there, I think, maybe the last time we spoke. I think people may know what the main pro of being there is, but it couldn't hurt to mention it. But also, I want to know if there are any cons.
Yeah, well, you know, there's always cons about living every place, right? No place is perfect. I mean, be nicer if they had more direct flights to the West Coast or some direct flights to the West Coast. And, you know, it'd be nicer if they had like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and a few other things that aren't here. But overall, I mean, the pros of living in Puerto Rico, at least where I live in Puerto Rico, I mean, that might not be the case for every neighborhood, but certainly where I'm living, far outweigh the negatives. I really enjoy my time here more so than my time in Connecticut, where I still spend several months a year in my home there, generally during the summer months. But, you know, I really like it here. In fact, probably the best thing about being here, other than how beautiful it is and, you know, the environment and the fact that I'm barely paying any taxes now, is the people. I mean, there are great people here that have come here, entrepreneurs from all over the country, even some from other parts of the world, because the tax benefits in Puerto Rico, while they're uniquely good for Americans, they're also attractive for people in Europe or, you know, other countries. So you meet a really good mix of people, a lot of good libertarian, free market oriented people with all sorts of businesses that have come here really in search of freedom, economic freedom, because they can grow their business without having to cut the government in for half of what they earn. But, you know, what's a little bit frustrating about it, particularly for my wife, and you'll appreciate this, there are a lot of California liberals, and not just California, Colorado and a few other states, where you have these limousine liberals that have come out here, and they're all big, you know, they were big Obama people, they're very liberal, yet they are here to avoid paying income taxes. right? And they've been supporting candidates who want to raise income taxes on the rich, yet they come to Puerto Rico to avoid the very taxes that they're in favor of everybody else paying. So that kind of hypocrisy kind of bothers us, particularly my wife. But, you know, me and the way I am, I don't want anybody to pay income taxes. I'm against the income tax for everybody. I don't want big government. I want small government. So there's nothing hypocritical about me coming to Puerto Rico and avoiding taxes. But there is about people who believe in big government and want big taxes. They just don't want to pay them themselves.
Yeah. No kidding. All right. I got a bunch of questions I usually solicit when I have Peter Schiff on the show. I got people dying to get their questions answered. So I solicited them from my private group. And a number of people want to know your opinion, which I'm sure you've stated numerous times, but all the same, your opinion on the trade war with China. How significant is that? What do you think about that? The impact of it, all that?
Well, you know, first of all, I've been saying for years, and this has also been covered in my books, you know, my first book, Crash Proof, and also in The Real Crash, that China has been providing a tremendous support to the United States economy that in the long run is going to prove to be very damaging because we've, you know, grown reliant on their generosity or their foolishness, however you want to look at it. But the Chinese have been supplying Americans with all sorts of manufactured goods that we used to manufacture ourselves, but no longer manufacture. And because we don't have to manufacture them, we don't have to do all the hard work. We don't have to make the capital investment. We don't have to have the skilled workers. We don't have to deal with maybe the pollution. We just get all these consumer goods. They just come here on ships. And we didn't have to do anything. We didn't have to expend any resources. The Chinese do all the work, and we get the fruits of their labor. And all we do is we give them IOUs. We print money that costs nothing, and they take that. And then, in fact, they take the money that they get, and they buy treasuries. They buy mortgage-backed securities. And that means we just get to spend the money all over again. I mean, so they loan us money. They supply us with stuff. So we have a higher standard of living. We have a greater abundance of goods, which means lower prices. And we have lower interest rates because Americans aren't saving, but we're certainly borrowing. And so we end up borrowing what the Chinese have saved. But if it wasn't for China and we had to produce all this stuff on our own and we could only borrow what we saved on our own, things would be very different in America right now. We would have a much lower standard of living. And right now, what we're really doing is we're poking a hornet's nest, and you know, we're biting a hand that's been feeding us, and people don't understand it. I mean, Donald Trump is correct when he looks at these enormous trade deficits and says it's a problem. And he's right. The people who say it's not a problem are wrong. It is a problem because we are financing these deficits by going into debt, by selling off our assets and going deeper and deeper into debt. This is a nation in decline. I mean, once upon a time, America generated enormous trade surpluses, and we were investing those surpluses all around the world. We became the world's largest creditor nation because of our surpluses. Well, now we're the world's biggest debtor nation because of our deficits. So this is not a good thing. But what Trump doesn't understand is in order to fix the problem, we are going to have to suffer a short-term decline in our standard of living because we've been living beyond our means, right? And the trade deficits have been enabling that, but at great cost to our future standard of living. So to really get to the root cause of the problem, we need much lower regulations on businesses. We need to shrink the size of government so that we can legitimately reduce taxes, not just run bigger deficits. And we have to allow the Federal Reserve to let markets push interest rates much higher so that we encourage the savings and investment necessary to make the capital investments to produce on our own. And we got to train the workers to work in, you know, the industries to produce these goods. But the transition is going to be painful. And of course, if we go from a real economy or from a bubble economy to a real economy, if the Fed lets interest rates go up, that means stock prices come down. That means real estate prices come down. That means people are going to lose a bunch of money. And the government's going to have to, when the government cuts spending, a lot of people who were counting on money from the government are going to be told that they're not going to get it. So a lot of things have to happen that are going to be problematic. And so we kicked the can down the road to avoid that.
Well, along similar lines, somebody wants to know about well, he's been following you closely, and he says, Peter has said the Fed is going to take interest rates back to zero and relaunch QE in an effort to reinflate the bubble when it bursts. But he says he doesn't think it's going to work this time around. Instead of reinflating the asset bubbles, it's going to tank the dollar, and we're going to have an inflationary recession. What does he see as being different this time? Why can't the Fed manage to do what it did after 08 and repeat the cycle again?
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, I didn't expect it to succeed the last time. I mean, that's one thing that I got wrong when I was writing my first book, Crash Proof, and I was predicting the bursting of the housing bubble and the Great Recession and the financial crisis and the bankruptcy of Fannie and Freddie and the worst recession since the Great Depression and trillion-dollar deficits and double-digit unemployment. All these forecasts that I was writing about in 05, 06, right, all that stuff happened, right, in 08. And then when I wrote that book, I said that the Fed was going to attempt to reflate the housing bubble and the stock market bubble. They were going to slash rates. They were going to print a bunch of money. And I thought that that would result in a dollar crisis, and that would result in a much bigger crash, right, than when we had in 08. Well, I underestimated the ability of the Fed to get away with, you know, quantitative easing and for the world to basically accept this and to enable this. And I think there were some other problems, too, that happened in Europe and the other parts of the world that kind of allowed us to go deeper into debt than I thought we would have been able to. So we were able to reflate the bubble. We actually made a bigger housing bubble than the one that popped. We have a much bigger bond market bubble, certainly with the help of the Japanese and the Europeans. And the stock market bubble, I think, if you look at it objectively, is actually bigger than the one that popped in 08. Especially if you count a lot of the stocks that are privately held, these so-called unicorns that aren't even public, but have these crazy valuations. So yes, they did succeed in reflating the bubble. Now, the question is, if they did it before, can they do it again? And I would not want to bet that that is possible, given the enormity of the problem now. So in order to do it again, right, the next round of quantitative easing is going to have to be much, much bigger than the last one. So, you know, they took the balance sheet up to $4.5 trillion last time. They might have to take it up to 10 or 20 trillion this time. They may have to do, you know, $200 or $300 billion of QE every month as opposed to $85 billion. And, you know, when they were doing it before, right, we had a lot of support. The Chinese were big buyers. The Russians were big buyers. You know, I don't see that kind of appetite for U.S. debt anymore, right? I don't think we're going to have a lot of help from those other countries who are already trying to minimize their exposure to the dollar now. I don't think they're really going to step it up in order to enable QE4. And if you remember the deficits, you know, the budget deficits under Bush prior to the 08 crash, you know, they were about $250, $300 billion a year, and we ran them up to $1 trillion. Well, they're already over $1 trillion now. In fact, if you count all the off-budget stuff that's not officially included in the budget, but we still have to borrow the money, we're running $1.5 trillion a year deficits now. So triple those, I mean, $3, $4 trillion a year. Is there any way the Federal Reserve can monetize $3 to $4 trillion a year of government debt without, you know, the dollar falling? And without igniting, you know, a big increase in inflation. In fact, on, you know, Thursday, we got the core CPI, which had the biggest increase in 11 years. I mean, it's only 2.4%, but of course, that's the way the government measures it. It's probably much higher than that. But if we already have an 11-year high in core CPI, where's it going to go from here, especially when the dollar starts to fall? Because the dollar is still near the highs, yet we have an 11-year high in core CPI. So I just think that the scale is now so enormous that it would be impossible that if the Fed tried to inject enough stimulus into this economy to try to reflate an even bigger bubble than the ones that we already have, I just think the economy dies of an overdose. We overdose on stimulus and we destroy the dollar, and then we have, you know, massive inflation, and then now the government is in a very big predicament, because is it going to allow the inflation to just run unchecked, or is it going to do something to stop it? But, you know, what would be required to stop it would be so politically damaging and just, you know, in the short run, that they may opt not to stop it, which case it's even worse. You know, this happens a little bit later.
Well, how does this all tie into the other day, Trump tweeting about what the Fed should do? I wish he would stop tweeting about the Fed. He couldn't be more wrong on this. But he's talking about they should take, I'm sure you saw this, they should take interest rates to zero or even lower. I have a lot of people asking questions about the meaning of negative interest rates and what we should think about this.
Yeah, well, you know, Trump, of course, has done a complete 180 on the Fed because as a candidate, he was critical of the Fed for being too easy, for doing quantitative easing, for keeping interest rates artificially low in order to just make the economy look better for Obama, but at long-term damage to the real economy. And that was something he promised to change. That's why he didn't reappoint Yellen, because he wanted somebody that wouldn't do the things that Yellen did. And now he's pissed off at Powell because he's not doing what Yellen did. He's pissed at Powell because he's not doing what he criticized Yellen for doing. So he was a complete hypocrite. He wants now a bubble. He doesn't want a real economy. He doesn't want to drain the swamp. He just wants to inflate the bubble. And in fact, when he was a candidate, he said it was a big, fat, ugly bubble. But now he loves it. Now he calls it a bull market and the greatest economy we've ever had. But it's the same bubble. And he just doesn't want any air to come out of it. But yeah, I saw that tweet. I replied to that tweet. You know, I replied to a lot of the president's tweets. Of course, he never replies back. He, you know, maybe if I flattered him, he might. But, you know, I basically tell the truth, so he has to ignore it. But, you know, what he was basically saying is we need the Fed to slash interest rates to negative so we could take advantage of that as a nation and refinance the national debt, restructure it, and lengthen the maturity so we could just take advantage of these cheap interest rates and help the taxpayer by, you know, extending the maturities. Well, I called them out for him being a hypocrite there as well, because there's nothing stopping the president from doing that right now. The yield on the 10-year is about 1.7. The yield on the 30-year just got back above 2%. I think it's around 2.1, 2.2. It got below 2. That was an all-time record low. What is stopping the president right now from refinancing the national debt at 2% for 30 years? I mean, that's a great deal, assuming he could actually find people dumb enough to buy those bonds. Why doesn't he do that? In fact, since Trump has become president, the average maturity on the national debt has actually shortened. So rather than taking advantage of these low rates, the president has opted to take the politically expedient route of continuing to finance the debt with shorter and shorter maturities to make the current deficit look smaller, right? So basically what he's doing is he is taking out the equivalent of an adjustable rate mortgage rather than locking in a fixed rate mortgage. See, most homeowners, if you intend to live in your house, you know, for 30 years, you take out a mortgage, you are going to opt for a 30-year fixed rate loan, even though you would get a better deal if you just took a variable adjustable rate, because you know that if rates eventually go up, and they will, that in the long run, the adjustable rate mortgage will cost you more. So you're willing to pay extra in the short run because you care about the long run. But when you're the president of the United States and you don't give a damn about the country because you have a 4-year term, right? What do you care what happens to the country in 8 years or 10 years? So what you do is you finance the national debt with T-bills instead of 30-year bonds, because then it's the other guy's problem when this ticking time bomb explodes. So Trump can claim all he wants that the reason he's not doing this is because of Powell. It's not. He's got plenty of opportunity to do it, but he refuses to do it because, again, he's not there to drain the swamp, right? He's just there to get reelected to preside over the swamp.
Peter, let's take a quick break, then we'll come right back. Let me tell you folks a little story. The other day, I was ordering online a giant 10-foot by 10-foot blanket. Don't ask me why I was ordering it. And Mr. Big Shot here thought he was the cool kid in town with his $25 off coupon code. Well, guess what? Honey found me a $37.25 coupon code, which made me $12.25 cooler than I was before. Look, if you're like me, you do a lot of online shopping, get to avoid the crowds, you get to see an amazing selection of products, and you have a secret weapon to make sure you're not overpaying online, and that's Honey, a free browser extension that saves you money everywhere you shop online. It finds coupon codes and other discounts across the web and applies them automatically. I don't know how it works, but it saves me money where I already shop. The average Honey user saves about $126 per year. That's like a half a dozen good quality hardcover books. Time magazine calls Honey basically free money. Over 10 million people are already saving with Honey. And listen, there's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use, installs on your computer in just 2 clicks, and it'll save you money so you can treat yourself to something nice. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/woods. That's joinhoney.com/woods. Peter, let's talk about Euro-Pacific Capital for a minute. What exactly is your role with Euro-Pacific Capital now? Has it changed? And can you give us an overview of Europac, Shift Gold, everything?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my roles are a little bit different, certainly ownership-wise. So Euro-Pacific Capital is a broker-dealer, or was a broker-dealer. I started that back in 1996. I actually bought a broker-dealer that had been started in 1980 and changed the name to Euro-Pacific Capital, but it didn't have any clients. And I built it up, you know, into a nice size, you know, small firm. But, you know, when I moved to Puerto Rico and, you know, the regulations also had been increasing and it's increasingly more expensive to be a small broker dealer in the United States. In fact, most of the small brokerage firms that were around when I started my firm have since gone out of business because, you know, the government keeps raising the bar. They keep passing new rules and new regulations. You know, a lot of it, ironically, started with the terrorist attacks in 2001. A lot of the anti-money laundering rules and other things that came out of the Patriot Act just really increased the cost of staying in business. And so most small firms have gone away. And so I decided to do the same thing. I basically sold the broker-dealer to some people that really were going to build it up to a much larger firm, something that I really did not have the desire to do at this point. But because, you know, to make it viable, it needed to be much bigger than it was. So either I could sell it to a bigger firm or sell it to people who would make it a bigger firm. And doing it the way I did it was very, you know, non-disruptive to my clients, my employees, because nobody had to change their account. Nobody had to transfer anything because I just found people that were willing to do really what I wasn't in a position to do. I wanted to focus on the asset management outside of the business, not running the broker-dealer. So I'm still an employee of Euro-Pacific Capital. The name was officially changed to Alliance Global Partners. So that's the new name of the broker-dealer. Euro-Pacific Capital is now a division of that company, which I head. But I manage all of the managed accounts from my business, Euro-Pacific Asset Management, which I still retain ownership of and I did not sell. That company I relocated from Newport Beach, California, to San Juan, Puerto Rico back in 2013. I've since moved the headquarters to Dorado, Puerto Rico, which is closer to my house. And so I work from here. Euro-Pacific Asset Management owns the family of mutual funds, the Euro-Pacific funds, my gold fund, which, by the way, I got an award for having the top performing gold fund for 5 years in a row, ending in December 2018, and the top performing fund for three years in a row. Got 5 stars by Morningstar. So I own that fund. I own my value fund, dividend payers fund, emerging market fund, and bond fund, all through my Puerto Rican company. And then, you know, my Shift Gold, I used to own that myself. I then sold it to a Canadian company, Gold Money, and we now have a deal to split the profits. So they run it, and I'm here, and I do the marketing for Shift Gold, but it's the same team. But I kind of wanted to divest myself of my U.S. businesses and have all my businesses operating out of Puerto Rico. I moved my bank, Euro-Pacific Bank. It used to be headquartered in St. Vincent's and the Grenadines. I've since moved that bank, and it's now here in Puerto Rico as well as an offshore bank. And most of my employees now are here in Puerto Rico. So I have two businesses here. I have quite a few employees here. I'm going to continue to grow these businesses. And again, you know, it makes it a lot easier when you're paying 4% tax. And especially, you know, if you look at the next election and look at all the Democrats and their proposals, one of these clowns is probably going to be president. In 2016, you know, before the last election, nobody thought Trump had a chance of winning. I mean, I thought he had a very good chance of winning. I didn't think it was a sure thing, but I thought he had a much better chance than the pundits were suggesting. And I didn't believe the polls. I thought the president was more popular than what the polls suggested. But here we are coming into 2020. The president is doing horrible on the polls. I mean, there's never been a sitting president polling this bad. Yet everybody thinks he can't lose. And I think, you know, it's much more likely that he will lose. And so that means one of these socialists is going to be the next president. But, the taxes are going to go way up. So who knows where the taxes are going to be in 2021. But at least I don't have to worry about it personally. because if they jack up the income tax, it doesn't affect me. If they jack up the Social Security tax, it's not going to affect me. Even if they manage to impose the wealth tax, I'm exempt from that too. I mean, the whole thing would be unconstitutional, but a lot of things the government does are unconstitutional, and they end up getting away with it. So assuming they get away with a wealth tax, they're not going to tax my wealth because I live in Puerto Rico. So, you know, if you're worried about what the Democrats could do, you know, come down here. And, you know, and even if the Republicans win, look, the deficits are enormous. Taxes are going up. There's no way around that, right? And if you don't want to pay them, you know, Puerto Rico's your way out if you don't want to give up your U.S. citizenship. You
know? All right, I got two more things I want to ask you before I'll let you go. And one of them's maybe related to what you just said about your companies, and that is, I think I get this every single time I have you on. Somebody says, what should the average Joe do, right? You get that question all the time. Peter, I listen to you. I think you're right. What should I be doing? Now, so I take it by average Joe that we're talking about people with not a lot of money to play with. So maybe you could answer in two ways. How about that guy? And then talk about somebody who does have a little money to play with. What should they do?
Yeah, so the average guy that doesn't have a lot of money, I think the easiest thing that you could do is just go over to goldmoney.com and open up an account. And, you know, you could buy some gold, you can buy some silver, you can buy $25 worth, $50 worth, $100 worth. You know, I mean, there, you carry it around on an app on your cell phone, but it's real gold and silver. You own it. It's not commingled with anybody else's. You can actually pick which vault around the world you want to keep it in, or you can keep a little in Singapore. You can keep some in Switzerland. You can keep some in Hong Kong. It's up to you. They're all Brinks vaults. It's all your name on it. You own it. But it's you know, it's 0.5% is the commission, 0.5% over the spot price. So it's a cost effective way to accumulate savings in gold and silver, because gold and silver are going to retain their value. So if you don't have a lot and you want to save something, save it in real money. If you hold on to dollars, the longer you hold them, the less they're going to buy. So you might as well just spend your dollars. But if you want to, you know, if you don't want to spend everything, if you want to save, then gold and silver are an easy way to do it. I think prices are still very low compared to where they're headed. So that's something. And, you know, and if you want to wear some of your gold, you know, if you don't want to have it all just on an app on your phone, you can go to mene.com, M-E-N-E.com, and they sell 24 karat gold jewelry. Now, this is not the most efficient way to buy gold, because the markups there could be 15, 20, 25%. But compared to, you know, the 1,000% markups you're going to get if you just go in the Tiffany's or something, I mean, you could buy a piece of jewelry, a gold bracelet, and it may have $1,000 worth of gold in it, and you pay $1,200 for it. But you got $1,000 worth of gold, but you can also wear it. So it's not bad. In fact, the people that were buying Mene jewelry when I first started talking about it a year ago, their jewelry is now worth more than they paid, even though they've been wearing it. And, you know, and you know, they can sell it back to the company whenever they want. So, you know, it's another way. If you want to buy yourself some jewelry, you know, don't waste your money buying, you know, spending $1,000 for a piece of jewelry that has $100 worth of gold in it. You know, you might as well, you know, spend $1,000 for a piece of jewelry that has $825 worth of gold in it. You actually have some real value. So that's for people that, you know, don't really have a lot and they're just trying to put something aside. But even if you have a little bit, you can go to my website, yourpacificfunds.com. My mutual funds have a $2,500 minimum. So you can buy any of my funds with just $2,500 directly from my asset management company, do that online. And you can set up automatic investment programs where, you know, $100, $500, you know, on a whatever basis will automatically be added from your bank account into my mutual fund. So that's a good way to accumulate a portfolio of international stocks or gold stocks. You know, I think, you know, if you're looking to really hit it big, I think a lot of these gold stocks could go up 10x, 20x, maybe 50x, who knows? So a small amount of money can go a long way in these stocks. Of course, you know, they're risky. I mean, if I'm wrong, I mean, they're going to go way down, but I don't think I am. But, you know, for people who have more substantial portfolios, people who are older, people who have accumulated, you know, a nest egg and they don't want to rot, which, in fact, I think a lot of Americans who are nearing retirement age are going to be in for a rude awakening, because they're never going to retire, because it's their money that's going to retire, not them. In fact, I think retirement in America is going to go the way of the single family breadwinner in a household. You know, once upon a time, you know, back in the 1950s, you know, 1960s, married women didn't work. I mean, that was reality. I mean, it was, you know, you'd be embarrassed if you were married and your wife had a job. But women didn't need to work. Well, now all women who are married need to work. In fact, a lot of women aren't even getting married now because they say their husbands don't make enough money to support them. So it's less incentive to marry. But I think eventually retirement will go the same way. I mean, people are not going to retire. They have no savings. The dollar is going to crash. They get wiped out in overpriced stocks. So people are going to work until they can't, until they basically drop dead. So, you know, if you want to be able to retire, you have to make sure that you have a portfolio of assets that will provide enough income from you that you can live off the income of your investments and ultimately the principal of your investments so that you don't have to live off your labor. And I think if you're going to do that, you better get your money out of U.S. assets, out of dollars, out of overpriced U.S. stocks and bonds. And I am building portfolios for clients at, you know, through Euro Pacific Capital, managing them through my company in Puerto Rico, of foreign stocks mostly, but, you know, some foreign bonds, but more equity oriented because I'm worried about inflation worldwide, not just here. So we're buying really good quality companies in countries that are not nearly as screwed up as the United States. I mean, they're all screwed up to a degree. It's kind of like a triage. But if you look at countries like Singapore or Hong Kong or even Sweden now, or Norway, Switzerland, Australia, you know, there are countries that are not as screwed up, right? I mean, they've got problems, but not nearly as great as the ones that we have. They save more, they invest more, they have trade surpluses, their governments, you know, finances are not, you know, that as out of whack. Their debt to GDPs are much lower. So you can find more stable. They rank high on the economic freedom index, which means there's, you know, there's more, fewer regulation, lower taxes. And I want to bet on those economies. But you buy stocks, property trusts, utilities, infrastructure companies, you know, good solid dividend paying stocks that will provide a meaningful source of income. And then again, we also invest in more aggressive stocks in the energy sector, in the mining sector, but also pay dividends. So I can create individual portfolios for you. I can manage them. I can get you into my mutual funds. I have a wrap program where I manage a portfolio of my mutual funds. So if you're in that boat, if you have, you know, an IRA that you could roll over to us or other accounts with substantial assets, you should work with us directly. You know, you go to the website, europac.com. You can see the 800 number. You can, you know, fill out an online request to have a broker give you a call, you know, just to consult with you and try to figure out how we can help, you know, you with your portfolio, especially now with the U.S. stock market is overpriced as it is. The dollar is overpriced as it is. If you still have money in the U.S. market, in the U.S. dollar, it's a great opportunity to get out.
Okay, one final thing, Peter, just an opportunity to reply to critics. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will say, you know, Peter was very good on the housing bubble, but he's a broken clock. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, anybody could say that I'm a broken clock until I'm right. If you're just looking at, you know, those big events, because prior to 2008, people called me a broken clock then. I mean, I didn't just start saying stuff in 2007. I was writing prolifically articles online about the housing bubble in 2004. And I was writing about the bad things that were going to happen. In fact, I can even point to episodes. I remember I was on CNBC, on Kudlow's show on CNBC with this guy, Don Luskin. And this was even after the subprime market had blown up, right? And he was saying to me, Peter, when are you going to stop coming on saying the sky is falling? You know, look, even the subprime market collapsed and it's no big deal. So when are you going to say, you know, you were wrong? You know, this is even after. And I said, well, you have to give it time. It, you know, it's not, it's, you know, and he says, well, you know, we've given it time. And I said, well, you know, all these assets that these banks are holding, you know, they're practically worthless, if not worthless. And he's like, yeah, well, so what? Everybody knows that and nothing is happening. Okay. And of course, then we had the financial crisis. So they were saying I was a broken clock for years and years until 2008. Now, anytime you see a problem early, and if you warn about it early, people are going to say you're a broken clock, right? And again, it's not just that I said we're going to have a crash. I was very specific about why we were going to have a crash, what was causing it, and what the consequences would be. So if I was just saying everything's going to hell in the handbasket, get out. Everything is going to collapse. The sky is falling. Without being specific, then maybe you could say, well, I'm just saying bad things and eventually something bad happens and I claim credit for calling it. But when the bad thing that happens, happens exactly the way I describe it would happen for the specific reasons that I said it would happen, I wasn't a broken clock. I was just ringing the alarm early. I was an alarm clock and I was going off early, which is the only way that you can sound an alarm. Because even if I sounded the alarm a day before the crisis, if I was so perfect that I said, tomorrow everything is going to collapse, that's not even good enough because most people can't move that fast. You know, they can't. So if you're going to warn people about an event, you got to warn early. And of course, if you warn early enough about something, maybe the powers that be could actually do something to, you know, make it not as bad, you know, try to prepare for it or, you know, prevent some of these really bad things from happening. And so now it's the same thing. You know, the Federal Reserve has doubled down on the mistakes that caused the 2008 financial crisis. And so I see all the same mistakes. And just like I was warning about the financial crisis in 2002 and 3 and 4, when Greenspan initially made the mistakes that ultimately caused it, I saw that Bernanke and Yellen made even bigger mistakes and they were laying the foundation for an even bigger problem. But again, I don't know exactly when all that stuff is going to blow up, right? I can see them, you know, setting the stage, but I don't know when the whole thing is going to play out. But that doesn't mean I'm wrong. Being early doesn't make me wrong. And I have never put a timetable. I mean, I didn't say, hey, this is the date where everything is going to collapse. But, you know, I tell a lot of people who try to accuse me of just, you know, hey, I was right once. If you actually listen to my podcast, and by the way, I just did my 500th podcast yesterday.
Excellent.
I'm not sure how many you've done, probably more than that. But,
well, you did a nice little recording when I hit my 1,000th, but this one today is 1,493, but the thing is, I'm not running multiple companies at the same time. I have more time for podcasting.
Yeah, and I was doing my radio show every day, 2 hours.
Yeah,
so yeah,
right.
But if you have been listening to those podcasts, and even earlier, there are so many smaller forecasts, and some even not so small, that I have made that have been accurate about a lot of things. Now, do I bat 1,000? No. I mean, nobody bats 1,000. But I think the people who talk about how I've only got one thing right, I think I've got so much more right than almost anybody that's in the financial industry. You know, you look at a lot of the people, you know, they're the broken clocks. They're always bullish, you know. And yes, okay, so as long as the market is going up, all right, they look like they're right. But I think if you look at so many of the things that I said would happen that people thought were impossible, and then they happen. I mean, most particularly the Federal Reserve aborting its attempts to normalize interest rates and prematurely ending quantitative tightening. These are things that I said would happen for years, but the markets, you know, thought they believed the Fed. They thought they would get back up to 3-4%. They thought the Fed was going to wind down their balance sheet. I knew that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, there are a lot of other things that have been happening that I forecasted would happen, you know, and they have, you know, look at the exploding budget deficits, look at the exploding trade deficits. You know, yeah, I said we have record trade deficits under Trump. You know, Trump didn't bring down the trade deficit. I said that we would hit new highs under Trump. Same thing with the deficits. I warned that the deficits were going to explode. I said the tax cuts were not going to pay for themselves, that the deficits would end up being bigger than they were. And you know, a lot of the things that I've been saying have been happening. The stuff that I said about Obamacare, all that stuff has come true. So I got a lot of calls that I've gotten right. But the thing is, if you're waiting for all the bigger calls to happen, if you're waiting for the dollar to collapse, if you're waiting for the bond bubble to pop and you're waiting for a sovereign debt crisis, if you're waiting for everything that I've said to happen, well, then what? Well, I mean, now, okay, so now I'm right and you're broke because you didn't follow my advice because all those things hadn't happened yet. So you ignore all the warning signs that I'm, you know, alerting you to and all the problems getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but you don't want to do anything about it until everything implodes. And, you know, sure, when that all happens, I know that finally people are going to have to say, oh, I guess you were right, Peter Schiff, you know. Maybe, or some people will say, well, you're a stop clock right now. You know, you were right in 2008, and I don't know when the next collapse is, whether it's 2021, 2022, whenever it's a complete implosion. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm positioned properly. You know, look at gold. Gold's up 50% now since the end of 2015. You know, people said gold was going to get killed once the Fed started raising rates. Well, they were all wrong. Once the Fed started raising rates, gold prices went up. You know, and people like to say, oh, Peter, you're wrong because you were telling people to buy gold at 1700, 1800. Yes, and I was telling them to buy it at 300. And I've been telling them to buy it at 1000. I've been telling people to put 5 to 10% of their money in gold, you know, for almost 20 years. And had they been doing that, they'd be much better off than had they not done it. In fact, gold has outperformed the Dow going back to 2001. But I've never told people to put all their money in gold, but I said put some. But all the other professional, you know, financial professionals tell people to put none, which I think is a very foolish advice.
All right, Peter, I'm going to link to the sites that you've mentioned over the course of the conversation. I'll put all of them up at tomwoods.com/1493, including a link to the Peter Schiff Show podcast, which, as you say, recently hit episode number 500. So all kinds of Peter Schiff stuff. You want to work with Peter, you want to listen to what he has to say, all that stuff will be up at tomwoods.com/1493. Well, thanks, Peter, for doing this. All my listeners appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Tom, keep up the good work. You know, you're doing a good job out there, you know, fighting the good fight for freedom and liberty. Wish we had more people like you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, as we wrap up, if you are in the market for libertarian merch, I would like to recommend my longtime listener, Josh, and his online store where he offers coffee mugs and t-shirts using print on demand. And they've got humorous slogans and sayings that you would expect. And he's especially heavy on Liberland merchandise. Of course, you know, the tiny little country that is trying to be born in the Balkans. Ain't nobody got Liberland merch. Well, now you do. So check it out at tomwoods.com/Josh. That's his store, tomwoods.com/Josh. You'll find some really cool stuff there. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I will link to that because I like Josh and I want to help him out at tomwoods.com/1493, our episode show notes page for today. All right, that's it. Now, tomorrow we're talking about the CIA and mind control with the author of a brand new book on that subject. That's Stephen Kinzer, by the way, who's been on the show before. That book was just released last week, and it's already causing a lot of, well, not controversy because you can't deny what he's saying, but it's generating a lot of good conversation. So you definitely want to be here for that. So talk to you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.